Please note, rewards offered are subject to change or expire. To the author's knowledge, reward amounts are current and valid as of this episode's air date and may be subject to terms and conditions. Please confirm all reward details with the relevant case authority listed in the show notes. Welcome back to Reward Offered. Hopefully you've missed us while we've been gone, but the good news is we're back and we're diving straight into another case, that of the Pierce family murders. There is a $1 million reward offered for information which leads to the conviction of the person or persons responsible for the murders of Meredith Pierce and her children, Adam, Travis, and Kerry. This for me is one of those cases where I just go, how had I never heard of this before? Be ready for a couple of unexpected tangents later in the case, that may or may not be relevant to ultimately identifying who had a hand in murdering a mother and three of her children. I did reach out to the South Australian Police hoping they might be willing to answer questions I had about the case, and to also indicate to what extent they believe either of these other events are possibly relevant. Unfortunately, my request was very politely declined, but we will discuss some of the questions I have as we go along. Let's get into the case. If any of the details of this case cause you distress, please reach out to Lifeline on 13 11 14 in Australia or a relevant crisis support service in your local area. On the morning of Sunday, January 6, 1991, the Metropolitan Fire Service was alerted by neighbours to a house fire in Jackson Street, located in the suburb of Parafield Gardens, a little over 20 kilometres north of Adelaide in South Australia. Meredith Lillian Pierce, who was 31, lived at the property with her husband Stuart, as well as their four children. Their three sons were named Adam John, 11, Travis Allen James, 9, Matthew, whose middle name I'm unsure of, 7, and their daughter, who was named Kerry J. Margaret, who was 2. The couple were in their 13th year of marriage, having tied the knot on the 26th of March 1977, when Meredith was just 18. There are conflicting reports of the exact time that fire crews arrived on scene, and we'll speak a little later about why this is so critical to deducing who may or may not be involved in the deaths. Some media reports describe a house engulfed in flames when first responders arrived, but I've read in other sources that the blaze was relatively contained and that this allowed for the preservation of a substantial amount of evidence. Other indications from detectives who were on scene were that, while the fire had damaged the scene, it was still evident what had transpired. In any case, assuming an arson report was conducted, the relevant details with regard to the setting of the fire, methods, accelerant placement, and timeframes would be useful to know given timing is such a crucial element of this case. Let's discuss how the victims were found. There are slight variations across reports for some of the victims, and I'll include those nuances where I know them, because it's relevant to the discussion of any possible offender profile that we'll get to shortly. Meredith was said to have been found tied to a chair in the master bedroom. She had been beaten, gagged with a towel, and in some reports, strangled with an electrical cord. All four victims are said to have died from asphyxiation, and two of the boys were supposedly also found tied to chairs. But while most reports say all three children had been found with plastic bags over their heads, some suggest that two-year-old Kerry was instead smothered. It is reported to have been concluded that all of the victims had died hours prior to the fire being set, although police initially refused to share that information. I couldn't find any indication of where the children were found in the home, but specifically where they all were in relation to Meredith and each other would be useful to know when considering the movements of a killer through the house. One Canberra Times article, released the day after the murders, states that Kerry's body was found in the same room as her mother, that being the master bedroom, and that the two boys were found in another room, but doesn't say which. We'll discuss possible additional injuries to the victims shortly. Two members of the family weren't located within the home. 7-year-old Matthew, who had been staying at a friend's house that Saturday night, and his father Stuart, who had been working his overnight shift at the BP service station at Wingfield, roughly a 15-minute drive from the family home. Unlike Matthew, though, Stuart couldn't be located. His shift at the servo had reportedly ended at 6:50 that Sunday morning, although according to the official Crime Stoppers case profile on their website, quote, there is no evidence that Pierce went home when his night shift at a Wingfield BP petrol station finished. End quote. To me, this is a weird statement to include in the brief profile. It's evident the working police theory, at least publicly, is that Stewart is responsible for everything. And if that's the case, the evidence that he went home is that the fire was lit, because the implication by police is that the fire was initiated in that window of time between when his shift ended and the initial calls to 000. In any case, Stewart's car, a 240K Datsun, was found that Sunday night abandoned at a suburban Kilkenny shopping complex. While not a method police would have likely utilised back in 1991, if there is any photos in existence of the driver's side of the vehicle with the driver's door open, recreating that exact seat position in a similar model, while not conclusive, could indicate if the height of the most recent driver of the vehicle was consistent with Pierce's known height. Initial articles stated that two rifles were missing from the house, a .22 caliber and the other a .303. Although later reports only list the .303, so I'm unsure if that means the .22 was accounted for at some point. A book titled Horrible Man by Leonie Wallace, which looks at another unsolved case, that of the Portland hair salon murders in the neighbouring state of Victoria, briefly discusses Stuart Pierce and the murders of his family, because at one point, it was suspected by police that he had possibly committed the Portland murders after going on the run. Interestingly, in the book, Leonie claims to have been told by former Victoria Police Homicide Squad Detective Senior Sergeant John Morrish that a knife had been used as a weapon in both crimes. This is the only place I can find any indication of a knife present in the Pierce murders, but given the alleged source, it seems highly credible. I mean, part of this officer's involvement in the Portland case seemingly was literally comparing the similarities and differences of the two cases in order to work out if it was the same perpetrator they were looking for. Detective Morrish is reported to have said that, quote, "the use of knives and the way he, Pierce allegedly, killed his wife and children," end quote, was one of the similarities that made him a suspect in the Portland case. Leonie indicates she attempted to verify the injuries in the Pierce family murders by applying to the South Australian Coroner's Court for copies of the autopsy reports, but says she was denied. She continued to try and confirm the involvement of a knife by phoning a former detective, Sergeant Harding, who had been a part of the initial investigative team on the Pierce case. While it's indicated that Sergeant Harding refused to go into specific details to confirm any use of a knife, some things he does say make me think it's more likely one was involved than not. Obviously, a mother and three young children being murdered is a horrific scene in itself, but the gravity of the effects the scene is implied to have had on Harding and other officers doesn't seem proportionate, at least to me, to the discovery of a woman who had been beaten and strangled, and children who had plastic bags over their head, even as distressing a scene as that would be to walk into. Harding indicates in Leonie's book that the partner with whom he was on scene with turned to him and said, "I can't do this anymore," and apparently resigned from the police force as a result of the Pierce case. Leonie also says Harding described the scene as horrific. Based on this information, I think it's more likely than not that a knife was involved, only furthering the abject horror of the notion that it's possible, perhaps even likely, that it was their husband and father bearing the weapon. It also raises further questions, though. Remember, the cause of death for all four is publicly reported as asphyxiation, but given the crime scene inferred by the comments of the officers Leonie spoke to, I would have expected if there was a knife involved that the cause of death would have been sharp force trauma. So if there was a knife involved, resulting in a scene described as horrific, either the causes of death being publicly attributed to asphyxiation is wrong, or another possibility is that injuries to the body or bodies occurred post-mortem. Unfortunately, without having access to those autopsy reports, all we're left with is speculation. But it's not baseless speculation. It's at least informed, right? Through the information supplied by current or former detectives in Leonie Wallace's book. A 2001 article says Detective Senior Sergeant Brendan McGee was the first detective on scene, and he was quoted as having said, "It's the worst scene I've had to investigate in 35 years in the police force, and I've looked over some gruesome death scenes in my time." Some 10 years after the murders, Detective Superintendent Paul Schramm indicated that evidence relating to a possible murder weapon had been gathered but could not be disclosed. That statement only further makes me question the causes of death being asphyxiation. Given we don't know where Stuart is, the usual "the husband did it" scenario obviously jumps to the forefront. But even with that option, there's still so many questions. What was the motive? Even police have said they would only be speculating on motive until they have the pieces of the puzzle. Why leave one child alive? Was that on purpose or an oversight? Did Stuart commit suicide after the murders, or did he go on the run? And is he still on the run, out there, somewhere? But if it wasn't Pierce, then who? Who would commit such a crime? Some speculate that the presence of cannabis in the house is evidence that the family could have been killed due to an unpaid debt or drug dispute. In the aftermath of the murders, police located approximately 25 cannabis plants growing in what was described as a small, yet elaborate, plantation contained within a concrete cellar located under the home. The 10 square meter bunker reportedly extended under the kitchen and lounge and was fitted with a hydroponic watering system, lights, and fans. 25 plants obviously isn't likely to be a cartel-level growing operation, but also doesn't seem to be a volume consistent with simply personal use. So I think it's probable Pierce was a local, low-level dealer, using it as a means to make some extra money on the side in an attempt to ease some of their financial pressures. This, of course, doesn't mean he didn't know or associate with more nefarious men or higher-level drug associates. I just don't think there's anything to indicate he himself was any higher up on the food chain, so to speak. I've seen some reports that Pierce was in dire financial strife at the time of the murders, while others say it was no more than the standard level of financial stress many Aussie families feel day to day. However, killing a, from all indications, innocent wife and three of her certainly innocent children over a debt or dispute, particularly in the manners reported or speculated, seems highly unlikely to me. I mean, how often are families being wiped out by drug dealers over slights? Surely we would have heard about this being a thing, especially in suburban Adelaide. Further, police claim there is no indication that anyone outside the house was involved in the murders. Disputes or debts could still be correlated to, even if not causation for the murders though. Perhaps Pierce was similar to John List, who 50 years ago in America murdered his whole family, including his mother, his wife, and their three children, all because he wanted to spare them the shame of losing their mansion. While List left a note, seemingly removing any doubt in that case as to who had done it, he also fled to another state, assumed a new name, and remarried. List eluded a nationwide manhunt for almost 18 years. He came undone by the story being featured on America's Most Wanted, and his cover being blown by a friend who recognized him from the age-progressed clay bust shown on the program. Which just goes to show that refreshing these cases in the public's mind can produce results, even decades later. Point being, I think it's at least a possibility that any alleged bikie or drug connections could have contributed to the motive for the murders, for example due to debt or dispute pressures that Pierce felt, but it not have been a person from those connections that was responsible per se. January 5th also wasn't the first death of the Pierce household. 6 months earlier, a pensioner by the name of Gary Austin, who had been living in a flat at the back of the house for some 8 years, committed suicide by hanging. Pierce was reportedly close with the man, which, if true, could certainly have contributed to an unstable mental and or emotional state for Pierce. Although in the week after the murders of Meredith and the children, at least one article suggested police were also investigating Gary's apparent suicide. I'm unsure though what became of that line of inquiry. Now let's look at the window of the crime. On the evening of Saturday, the 5th of January 1991, Meredith's sister says she spoke to her on the phone at around 9 p.m. and that Meredith gave her no impression that anything was wrong or that she had any concerns. Apparently there was indication Stuart was still in bed at the time, because her sister recalls Meredith rousing on the kids during the call for making too much noise. She said the conversation was brief, lasting only about 10 minutes. Stuart, Meredith and her sister all worked at the same BP service station, with the women reportedly working days together and Stuart working the overnight shift. It was reported that because Meredith didn't have a license, her sister would often pick her up and take her to work, or drop her home afterwards. It seems the service station is about a 15-minute drive from the Pierce house. There is mixed reports as to exactly what time Stuart's shift started and ended. This is obviously key information I would like to confirm, given timeframes are such a crucial element of the case. The consensus seems to be that he finished at 6:50 a.m. Start times reported include 9 p.m., which can't be the case if he is still home and asleep when Meredith is on the phone around that time, and several articles suggest he would have left for work around 11:30 p.m. 12 a.m. to 6:50 seems like a really short overnight shift to me, but The sister that spoke with Meredith the night of the murders and worked at the same servo seemingly indicated in a 2016 article that Stuart did in fact start at 12 a.m. on the night shift, so we'll work off that. In any case, I would really like clarification of exactly what Stuart's start and finish times were, especially given there seems to be no suggestion that he was late to work or that he left early. The question of exactly when fireys arrive on scene and what time arson investigators best estimate the fire was set are crucial. It doesn't necessarily help us determine who killed Meredith and the kids if it is correct that they had been murdered hours prior, but it does help establish the timeline of the crime and, in particular, if Pierce himself even had time to set the blaze. It would help inform us as to just how narrow the window is for Pierce to return to the property, set it alight, and disappear before being seen. Unlike the varying start times reported, 6:50 a.m. is the only end time for the shift that I've come across, so again, we'll work with this. Obviously, at least one individual took over from Pierce when his shift finished. Again, we have no indication from police that he left early. We know his house is a 15-minute drive from work. Let's assume the guy's speeding because he's rushing to complete the task. Even if we are incredibly lenient and halve the drive time to 7 minutes, which is a bit absurd, but hang with me. If we're to believe the information on the South Australian Crime Stoppers website, fire services attended the Jackson Street property at 7:10 a.m. One outlet listed the firefighters as having been dispatched from the Salisbury Command Fire Station, which is listed as a 9-minute drive on Google. We now have to work forwards and backwards to find the window for Pierce. If he leaves work right on the dot at 6:50 a.m, our very quick, very lenient 7-minute drive puts him home at 6:57. Crime Stoppers says fireys arrive at 7:10. If we assume they're clocking above the speed limit and shorten it to even a 6-minute drive, that's a departure time of 7:04 for them. Even if the neighbours looked out their window at 7:03, call 000 immediately, and the fireys leave less than 60 seconds later, that leaves only a 6-minute window between 6:57 and 7:03 for Pierce to get home, spread the petrol accelerant around the house, light it, and have disappeared before neighbours notice the blaze and report it. Curiously though, no one reports seeing Pierce or hearing his Datsun, which was apparently well known to neighbours for how loud it was. One could reasonably argue that a 7-minute drive is just far too lenient for Pierce, but the problem is if we increase the drive time, we narrow the window, possibly as low as 1 to 3 minutes. Is that doable? Sure. Is it likely? For a guy who, if guilty, seems to have had quite a few things go wrong in his plan, he's now suddenly moving with the speed and efficiency of a James Bond or Ethan Hunt. Narrowing the window even further, neighbours of the Pierce house reportedly heard 3 or 4 minor explosions at what they estimate to be 7 a.m. Initially, my thought was that this was the gas bottles that police say appeared to be strategically placed around the house, exploding. We have no indication of how many gas bottles were placed around the property, but the presence of any more than 2 could likely be another possible indicator of premeditation. I know growing up we always had 2 gas bottles around the house. There was the one currently attached to the barbecue and the full spare tank. I would think having any more than 2 or maybe 3 on hand would be out of the ordinary, even for a guy who worked at a servo. But reports say police indicated that the gas bottles failed to explode. So my next guess would be windows blowing out due to thermal stress. Or, given we know there was weapons usually stored at the property, there is a possibility it could have been ammunition cooking off, which refers to the detonation of unloaded ammunition due to heating, or thermally induced firing of a loaded weapon. So, if neighbours report hearing sounds associated with a fire at approximately 7 a.m, Pierce finished at 6:50 a.m, that's 10 minutes. 10 minutes to make a 15-minute drive, douse a house in petrol, and flee without being seen. Reports say that there was blood belonging to Meredith found in the boot of the Datsun and also on a door trim, but don't specify which door of the vehicle. The blood is reportedly assumed to be transfer from Pierce. I can't see any evidence of or reason for needing to touch the bodies the following morning, so it seems likely any transfer would have happened after the murders and before he attends work. This is also where knowing the volume of blood in those 2 locations would be useful. Are we talking specks? Smudges, pools? Is the blood in the boot on the floorboard, or is it on an item? Blood being described as transfer on a door trim would usually make me lean towards it being transfer from a hand. But if it was from a hand, you would expect there to be transfer in other locations that you would also assume one's hand would touch. The exterior and interior handles, the steering wheel, maybe the seatbelt. Surely those weren't just that effectively cleaned. The only other items revealed as being found in the Datsun were several what were described as sale-ready bags of cannabis that were located in the console. But why leave that? Why not take it to sell? Unless he just forgot to take it. I'm also curious if police have proven, via security cameras or such, that Stuart was in fact at work all night. Is it possible he snuck back at some point during the night to commit the murders? Most servos only have one staff member working across those hours even today, so there may have been no one to notice his absence. I guess if it was Pierce, though, it doesn't matter whether the murders occur prior to the shift or during. That doesn't really help us prove anything one way or another, unless we could confirm him having left his post at the servo. If Stuart Pierce is guilty, what do we know about people who commit such crimes? And does that align with any of the known evidence in this case? Familicide is a multiple victim homicide in which the killer's current or estranged spouse and one or more children are slain. I couldn't find a consistent definition of a family annihilator to determine whether the name is appropriate in situations where any children are spared or survive. But given the circumstances of this case, regardless of the fact that Matthew survived, I believe Pierce, if guilty, would be considered an annihilator. An annihilator case still fresh in Australians' minds at present, given the recent conclusion of the coronial inquest in Brisbane, is the depraved and heartbreaking murder of Hannah Clark by her estranged husband Rowan Baxter, who also took the lives of their three children on the 19th of February 2020 in Queensland. Hannah was on her way to drop the kids at school when her car was intercepted by Baxter. He climbed into the passenger seat of the vehicle with a can of petrol and wielding a knife. He then reportedly doused the car and his family in petrol before setting it alight, with his three children still buckled in the back seat. The car then exploded. Hannah was able to escape the vehicle, but as the car was engulfed, Baxter actively interfered with the selfless efforts of bystanders, who tried desperately to extinguish the flames and rescue the children. He then proceeded to stab himself to death with a single puncture to his own heart. The children died at the scene. Hannah, despite her wounds, through her sheer strength and determination, was able to provide first responders with her account of what her ex-partner had done. She was rushed to the Royal Brisbane Hospital with horrific burns to some 97% of her body. But perhaps mercifully, given the loss of her children and the gravity of her wounds, succumbed to her injuries later that day. Domestic and family violence has been at the forefront of public discussion in Australia in recent years. Some would be aware of statistics such as that on average, one woman a week and one man a month are killed by a current or former partner. But far less, I suspect, are aware of the statistics of children killed by parents, an act known as filicide. In Australia, on average, one child every 2 weeks is killed by a parent, step-parent, or equivalent guardian. Family annihilators, as I believe Stuart Pierce, if guilty, would be considered, haven't been studied nearly as much as killers who commit familicide or filicide. However, a 2013 British study found that annihilators are most likely to be males and aged in their 30s. Perpetrators are overwhelmingly not known to police and have no history of mental illness. They often have stable employment, often in well-paid or prominent roles, and are surrounded by a close network of family and friends, who often describe them as dedicated husbands and devoted fathers. Researchers identified the four most common areas which may cause this type of crime. Breakdown of the family unit was the most common trigger, followed by financial strain, then cultural honour killings, and finally mental illness. Don't let the term trigger fool you, though. These crimes were almost always not crimes of passion, but rather planned, often over weeks or even months. The study identified four distinct possible characteristics which could drive a family annihilator. 1. The self-righteous killers who hold their spouse responsible for the breakdown of the family unit. These men will often call a victim and even explain ahead of time exactly what they plan to do. These men also see their breadwinner status as central in their idea of the perfect family. 2. The disappointed killers, who feel like their family has let them down in some way and destroyed their vision of an ideal family life. 3. anomic killers, who view the family as a symbol of their financial success, and financial turmoil or bankruptcy causes the family to be deemed dispensable as they no longer serve that function. And 4. Paranoid killers, who perceive a threat often from social services or the legal system, and are motivated by a twisted desire to protect their family from that threat. The study found perpetrators were most often characterized as self-righteous or anomic. Self-righteous killers will often choose a significant date, such as Father's Day, to commit their crimes. Interestingly, the study also found just under half of the murders were committed on a weekend, especially on a Sunday. Although in the Pierce case, the police theory seems to be that Pierce murdered his family before going to the overnight shift, meaning their deaths would have technically occurred on Saturday night. But another interesting point in the study indicated that murders were most likely to occur in August, but the inference here was that this was related to it being the school summer holidays at that time in Britain, the location of the study, which would coincide with the January 6 date in Australia falling during our school summer holiday period. One final point to note from this particular study that could be pertinent to this case was that it found 81% of men attempted suicide after the act. This would make it more likely that if Pierce was guilty of the crime, that he did commit suicide afterwards. However, although I couldn't find any indication, I would imagine that the majority of suicide attempts within the study were not undertaken in such a manner that their bodies weren't or would never be recovered. Given his body has never been found, this could contradict the idea that Pierce committed suicide. But as already stated, South Australian police have suggested they have no evidence to indicate one way or the other. A 2019 paper titled Topology of Familicide Perpetrators in Australia reaffirmed the appearance of four dominant action modes for such killers: expressive, adaptive, integrative, and conservative. Based on the descriptions of these four action modes, along with the surface indications of Pierce's personality, I believe the most likely modes to align with an idea of Pierce as the perpetrator would be adaptive or conservative. The elements from each that may align with this case will be apparent. The authors of the study, Cullen and Fritzen, found adaptive offenders would, quote, engage in a range of actions which revealed clear, instrumental motives and implied a consciousness of guilt. They tended to move, hide, or abandon victims' bodies and weapons, undertaking a series of planned actions over time. They staged crime scenes, and their killing methods were hands-on, strangling, suffocating, bludgeoning. They engaged in overkill in an effort to guarantee victims' deaths. Their activities were associated with unwanted pregnancies in their partners and their own extramarital affairs, with motives related to wanting to abandon their current family. There was a prevalence of cluster B personality traits, as expected. End quote. Those with cluster B traits often struggle maintaining healthy relationships and are characterized as being dramatic, emotional, and unpredictable in their thinking and behavior. The cluster B personality disorders are antisocial personality disorder, borderline personality disorder, histrionic personality disorder, and narcissistic personality disorder. The study found that the main goal of adaptive offenders was best described as escape. An unexpected find was a significant association with trauma, although the reason for the link was unclear. The other action mode that most closely aligns with the crime is conservative. Conservative offenders and the indicators associated with them was found to be often inconsistent, although previous studies have found unique case-by-case variations in the external triggers and internal reactions of conservatives, which may explain this. Conservative offenders were, quote, characterized by an intact marital relationship and the presence of a trigger such as financial concerns. They still retain emotional connections to their victims and tend to use hands-off methods such as fire and drowning, for which they may not posthumously be held responsible. The use of multiple killing methods in this group appeared to be related to poorly conceived or badly executed plans, plus the desire to ensure the demise of the family. End quote. Elements from adaptive offenders that could align with this case include planning actions over time, the staging of the crime scene, the use of hands-on methods with strangling and suffocating, and possibly elements of overkill. Alignment with a conservative offender could be the use of hands-off methods such as fire, although admittedly that wasn't a cause of death, possible multiple killing methods, and or poorly conceived or badly executed plans, for example, the suspected failure of the gas bottles to ignite the previous night and the requirement to return to the scene to set the fire using the petrol accelerant on the Sunday morning. I've seen nothing in my research to indicate an alignment with the expressive or integrative modes beyond substance use, which is admittedly purely presumed by me given the presence of the cannabis plants. One article I found did suggest that the suicide of Gary Austin had triggered a fall into alcohol and drugs for Stuart, but I've seen no indication from family that they had noticed any considerable changes or red flags in the lead up to the murders. At a press conference in 2014, Detective Inspector Hutchins, who was addressing the media, said he believed Stuart was known to police but didn't elaborate in what context. A 2001 article in the Sunday Times of Adelaide, though, claimed that a drink driving offence was the major blemish on Pierce's record. I've seen no indications Pierce was known to have been previously abusive to his wife or children, nor that he was prone to explosive outbursts. The methods of killing are also inconsistent with either of the expressive or integrative modes, so we won't look into those any further. Our only insight into the marriage is comments made by one of Meredith's sisters when she spoke to the Advertiser in 2016, describing their relationship as full-on. She assigned Stuart as the dominant personality and said that while she knew the couple to argue, it was only ever over the usual issues, for example, the children, finances, or Stuart spending too much time with his friends. She also described Meredith as easygoing and placid, someone who just got on with things and did what needed to be done. Unfortunately, without a deeper understanding of the family dynamics and further information regarding Pierce's innate personality traits from those closest to him, it's difficult to delve any further into which modes or profiles Pierce was more closely aligned with as a possible perpetrator. The 2001 article previously mentioned in the Sunday Times also suggested Pierce was known to be hyperactive and turned to drinking at times, but didn't indicate the source of the information. There's other things that are bugging me in this case too. For example, I could understand having planned to stage a fire to cover his DNA at the scene, or maybe a lack of foreign DNA. But whether your plan in the aftermath is to kill yourself or flee, why on earth go to work? Why not just end it? Or call in sick and take off with a head start? Which makes me think that neither of those were the original plan. Based on the fact he goes to work, I think the initial plan actually changed at some point. Most likely when the plan started going off the rails. My suspicion would be that if Pierce did set gas bottles in an attempt to time a blaze closer to when the murders occurred, I don't think the planned fire had anything to do with covering up evidence. I think it was purely a means to try and establish an alibi. He needed someone to notice a fire while he was at work. When that didn't happen, the plan had to change. The murders are done, and your alibi's fallen through. What option is left but running? I don't think he had planned suicide, at least not at the time of starting his shift. Because again, why bother with the shift? I find it hard to believe that someone murders the majority of their family and then decides to sit through one last overnight shift at BP before ending it all. Of course, that doesn't mean he didn't come to that decision later, months or even years down the track when reflecting on what he'd done. But again, what are the chances that he would commit suicide in such a way that would result in his body never being discovered? And would he really go to the lengths of concealing his own body? Why? Purely to keep the possibility of his innocence alive in the minds of friends, family, and strangers? I guess it's possible. Which brings me to another point. Why go back to the house in the morning? Even if the initial fire plan failed, it's no longer an alibi. There's now a huge inherent risk of him and/or his car being spotted at the crime scene by returning. He can't have parked a couple of streets over, the time window just doesn't allow for it. Or if the plan was to make it look like someone else was responsible for the murders and he was, I don't know, kidnapped, why risk being spotted and blowing that story too? Why is setting the fire that important to him that he would take on the increased risk of returning to the scene? Then again, it's possible that once things stopped going to plan, it just all went downhill from there and he kept making poor decisions. I mean, look at Chris Watts. He was never going to get away with that, no matter which way you spin it. His decisions only got progressively worse. To be fair, though, we have no idea where Pierce is, so perhaps he did manage to make it work in the end, despite how messy it seems. Another tidbit I found interesting comes from an article dated the 15th of January 1991, and refers to police wishing to speak to a man described as being in his mid-20s, who they say bought $5 worth of petrol in a 20-litre drum from a BP service station on the Salisbury Highway, north of Adelaide, at about 6:40 on the Sunday morning in question. I'm not sure if they ever located that man, but we know it can't be Stuart because he's still at work. And why would he need to stop off at another BP to buy fuel? He worked at one. So if it is linked to the case and can't be Stewart, who is it? Was there any evidence of a similar drum found at the crime scene? I was curious how full a 20-litre drum would be, presuming it was empty, if it was filled with $5 worth of petrol at 1991 prices. Answer, 62.25% full. Thanks, Dad. The Salisbury Highway also happens to be a main arterial road that runs straight past the suburb of Parafield Gardens. Now, I'm not sure which BP this sighting occurred at, but as at 2022, there are 6 or 7 BPs within a 5 to 10 minute drive of the Jackson Street house, so I would find it likely that the BP in question in 1991 was also within a similar drive time. In the next episode, we'll take a closer look at the possible sightings of Pierce since the murders. We'll discuss possible theories, as well as what the surviving child Matthew believes happened to his family. There's also a couple of curveballs that I bet you won't see coming. No one foresaw the events that would unfold on January 5th, 1991. Or did they? In an eerie twist of fate, just 6 months before the Pierce family murders, Meredith's sister recalls the women had their palms read by a truck driver during one of their shifts. He told the sister she would win the lotto. And sure enough, 8 months later, she's 3K richer. But his prediction for Meredith was chilling, warning her, "If you don't change your lifestyle, you'll be dead by the end of the year." His prophecy was out by less than a week. If you believe you may have seen Stewart Pierce at any point since January 1991, or have any information regarding the murders of Meredith, Adam, Travis, and Kerry, including alternate suspects, please contact Crime Stoppers on 1-800-333-000. Or you can also submit a tip online at crimestopperssa.com.au. The reward offered for information in this case is $1 million. The book written by Leonie Wallace and referred to in this case is titled Horrible Man, Sinister Secrets and Truth Untold, The Portland Hair Salon Murders. What do you think so far? Does this just seem like another clear-cut, the husband did it scenario to you? We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at reward_offered. Be sure to head to our socials for the age-progressed photos of Stewart and other case media. If you want to send us information on cases we've covered or suggest cases for us to cover in the future, you can email us at rewardofferedpod@gmail.com. That's it for this episode, kids. Part 2 should be up on the feed, ready to go. It's good to be back. Thanks for listening.